The Another World is Possible audio podcast brings you Toward the Destruction of Schooling, Chapter 2, The History of Schooling. The following quote is from Horace Mann. Quote, "It may be an easy thing to make a republic, but it is a very laborious thing to make republicans." Quote, "The family and the tribe are the schools of savages," wrote James Milburn. It would be far more accurate to say that, quote, "savages don't have schools," but that would perhaps bring the whole idea of schools into question, or at least get the reader to think about how tribes have been replaced by schools, families, by classes. If modern schools are presented as simply more advanced forms of something that has always existed, they somehow seem more unavoidable, a part of our, quote, "human nature." Schooling is necessary to a society to the extent that a given society constitutes a social order where individuals are subordinated to some collectivity. Government and hierarchical social relations maintain, quote, "social order" in civilized societies and are therefore prerequisites for the development of schooling. The development of writing systems in Sumeria and Egypt set the stage for the first specialists in the modern sense, scribes. Writing evolved as a way of monitoring wealth, keeping track of the size of armies, and recording monetary transactions, important functions of power for early cities. Scribes, or intellectuals, have always existed to serve the interests of power. Schooling was originally intended for scribes and other functionaries who occupied administrative and priestly roles. The impersonal relationship of students to an authority figure who instructs them is thus historically very intimately tied to the function of power. Schools developed as adjuncts to the temple courts of the ruling castes of ancient cities. Accounting, mathematics, chemistry, astronomy, and a significant amount of literature concerned with religious themes grew out of these first specialized intellectual environments. Along with all these cultural pursuits, emphasis was always placed on morality and good manners, renunciation being at the root of the work ethic so essential to schooling. Education in the East shared these characteristics. Hindu schools stressed mental purity and self-discipline, which were religious as well as school virtues. It is with Greece that the Western tradition in education is said to begin. Greek education was originally concerned with the ideal of the noble warrior. Slowly, this heroic culture became more of a scribe culture, although the written word was not to be the sole concern of education until all learning was organized around the Book of Books, the Christian Bible. In Sparta, education had an essential military character, its chief purpose being the training of the hoplites, or heavy infantry. Athenian education was never as strictly organized as that of Sparta. Nonetheless, the ephebia of Athens were schools for future soldiers organized by the state. The ephebia, however, eventually lost their military focus, ceased to be compulsory, and began teaching philosophy and rhetoric to the wealthy that would never have to work. Prior to the 6th century BCE, Greek education was generally, quote, "artistic rather than literary, athletic rather than intellectual." Many Greek cities, especially Athens, were developing a very active political life around this time. This more democratized Athens developed forms of collective education that paved the way for the development of the school as an institution. The Sophists responded to the need for a new ideal of education and began to teach students with the intention of molding successful citizens, people who are intellectual, scientific, and rational. If, quote, "man is the measure of all things," as Protagoras said, are Sophists the best measurers? The Sophists went from town to town searching for pupils, literally selling their skills. They became the first paid teachers. Their approach was looked upon contemptuously by many who saw education as encompassing so much more than practical pursuits. Nonetheless, they laid the foundation for the more highly developed Hellenistic education that would consist of a complex course of studies undertaken from the age of 7 to 20. Although there were no infant schools in Greece, Plato felt that children should go to school at 6. Aristotle felt that 5 would be the most sensible age to begin, and Chrysippus was modern enough to say 3. Schooling was beginning to assume great importance in the minds of influential thinkers. Plato felt that with schooling, man becomes, quote, the most divine and most civilized of all animals, unquote. Without it, quote, he is the most savage of earthly creatures, unquote. Still, for all his seriousness about preparing the next generation of political leaders, the academy he founded was incredibly informal by modern standards. Roman education was originally very different from intellectual Hellenistic education. Whereas the Greek boy was led to school by a slave, a pedagogue, the Roman boy stayed at home and was raised by his mother and educated by his father until he was old enough for military service. As Rome extended its empire, Greek influence increased, and eventually Roman schools were created for the purpose of training administrators and state functionaries. Still, there was never any general scholastic policy as what was to be developed later by the modern nation-state. Christianity developed in the midst of Greco-Roman civilization, and its educational practice would incorporate both Greek intellectualism and Roman severity, absorbing what is perhaps the most persistent theme of Western education, the ideal image of man. Man who bowed down before the law and sacrificed himself for an ideal. The first Christian schools were the catechetical schools of the first centuries CE, Common Era, where instruction was exclusively oral. They were institutions of higher learning in the sense that they were geared toward an older audience. They were principally concerned with instructing pagans in Christian beliefs so that they could be baptized. The monastic school, originally created for future monks, appeared in the 4th century, and they became the first genuine Christian schools. Cathedral schools, which were provided by every cathedral, were a later development, and the enrichment of their program helped bring about the rise of the universities during the medieval period. From the 11th century onward, the church was very much concerned with the development of an effective educational system. At the same time, the characteristics of higher education were being established between the 11th and 16th centuries. Frederick Eby writes, quote, by the end of the 15th century, 79 universities were recognized in Western Europe. Almost all had the blessings of the Pope, even if they did not owe their initiation to papal decree. Most of the students were laymen and secular subjects such as law, medicine, and the sciences dominated their interest more and more. Unquote. With the rise of Christianity, education came to have a fundamentally moral aim. Discipline was becoming ever more precise as living and learning became more and more conditioned by set parameters of space and time. The 16th and 17th century grammar school that was physically separated from the church was the product of the Renaissance and the Reformation. The humanism of the Renaissance stimulated a greater interest in intellectual activity and classical learning, while the Reformation moved beyond the traditionalism and formalism of medieval times. In terms of schooling, the two movements seemed to work in harmony. Martin Luther, who was a staunch advocate of schooling, influenced the growth of lower schools throughout Northern Europe. With Gutenberg's invention of movable type, more and more Bibles were being printed, and universal education if not a humanist ideal, was rapidly becoming a Christian one. The provincial schools and the Christian elementary schools of the 17th century were founded principally to combat the ignorance of God and idleness among the poor. Comenius, an educator born in 1592, believed that children are not born human, but can become human through the proper training. Educating them thus became God's purpose. Christian schools not only trained docile children, but also tried to make sure parents stayed faithful and replicated the discipline of the school and the home. The advancements of science during the 17th and 18th centuries in the Common Era permanently changed the ways in which schooling was viewed and implemented. In Francis Bacon's Unfinished Utopia, The New Atlantis, the inhabitants of the perfect commonwealth organize a scientific society, the end of which is, quote, the knowledge of causes and the secret motions of things and the enlarging of the bounds of human empire to the effecting of all things possible, unquote. Bacon's book influenced the founding of the Royal Society and the scientific academies, while some of his short essays, such as quote, Of Marriage and the Single Life and Of Parents and Children, signal the decreasing importance of the family and traditional social groupings. Descartes, too, made observations that very clearly represented the increasing importance of science. He came to the conclusion that he was, quote, a substance to the whole essence or nature of which is simply to think, and which, in order to exist, has no need of any place, nor depends on any material thing, unquote. Science was slowly beginning to replace religion, in the sense that it occupied the same place as an object of faith, a good in and of itself. The Enlightenment, which discovered the liberties, also invented the disciplines, wrote Foucault. In the 18th century, rank begins to define the great form of distribution of individuals in the educational order. Rows or ranks of pupils in the class, corridors, courtyards, rank attributed to each pupil at the end of each task and each examination. The rank he obtains from week to week, month to month, year to year, an alignment of age groups, one after another, a succession of subjects taught and questions treated according to an order of increasing difficulty, unquote. The individual was more and more enmeshed in a psychogeography shaped according to the interests of power. Such is the shape of the new schooling which being forged during the Enlightenment, soon to be systematically applied to the nations by the nation-state. George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, for example, both saw education as a way to create a more, quote, homogeneous citizenry. Benjamin Rush, echoing Aristotle's thinking, spoke the hidden truth of schooling, quote, let our pupil be taught that he does not belong to himself, but that he is public property, unquote. In the United States, the Puritans were the first people to be preoccupied with schooling. According to Puritan thinking, the child was, quote, not only ignorant, but sinful in nature, unquote. The preacher, coincidentally also the main teacher in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, was there to raise them up to civilized status. In accordance with the philosophy of John Calvin, Massachusetts voted for, quote, the compulsory establishment of schools, ordering every town, that is, township of 50 households, to establish an elementary school, and every town of 100 households, a secondary school as well, unquote. Virginia was much less concerned with universal education. Tutors were often hired by the wealthy to prepare their boys for college, usually William and Mary or a European school, but the poor had less opportunity for education. Quote, in moving from 17th century Massachusetts to 18th century Virginia, one senses a marked decompression in religious climate. In place of sin and profanes, the Virginia teacher's foes become the awkward and uncouth. The character of American education was nothing new. Quote, both Noah Webster and Benjamin Rush believed that the teacher should be an absolute monarch, unquote. The classroom was rapidly becoming an instrument for the formation of modern Republicans. Benjamin Franklin's virtues of temperance, silence, order, resolution, frugality, industry, sincerity, justice, moderation, cleanliness, tranquility, chastity, and humility were perhaps the bourgeois virtues par excellence. These values were becoming ever more entrenched in society as industry progressed and industriousness became the absolute good. Quote, the workshop, the school, the army were subject to a whole micropenality of time, lateness, absences, interruptions of tasks, of activity, inattention, negligence, lack of zeal, of behavior, impoliteness, disobedience, of speech, idle chatter, insolence, of the body, incorrect attitudes, irregular gestures, lack of cleanliness, of sexuality, impurity, indecency. Each subject finds himself caught in a punishable punishing universality. Unquote. Arising out of the belief that the existing schools were not systematic enough to accomplish their purpose, and starting in the urbanizing, industrializing regions of the East, where America was acquiring a mostly foreign-born proletariat, the Common School movement strove for universal, quote, free public education. As the state's attitude toward economic life was becoming more non-interventionist, its attitude towards education was changing in the opposite direction. The 1837 founding of the Massachusetts Board of Education and the appointment of Horace Mann as its first secretary marked the transition into the modern epoch of education in America. The blazing humanitarianism of the advocates of popular education was chiefly concerned with integrating masses of people into the new industrial economy and diffusing social tensions created by increasing inequality. Michael B. Katz disproves the myth that the working class struggled for popular education. Quote, the committees, school committees, saw themselves arrayed against the mass of parents, whom they considered uncomprehending and indifferent. School committees were unashamedly trying to compose educational reform and innovation on this reluctant citizenry. The communal leaders were not answering the demands of a clamorous working class. They were imposing the demands. They were telling the majority, your children shall be educated, and as we see fit. Promoters represented educational reform, especially the high school, as an innovation directly aimed at urbanizing, industrializing communities. The high school was simultaneously to foster mobility, promote economic growth, contribute to communal wealth, and save towns from disintegrating into an immoral and degenerate chaos. Horace Mann called education, quote, the great equalizer of the conditions of men, the balance wheel of the social machinery, unquote. Since schooling was becoming more democratic, common school reformers were trying to appeal to everyone. To employers, he, Horace Mann, claimed that schooling made workers more industrious, obedient, and adaptive, thereby increasing their output. To working people, he held out the hope of increased earnings. The overall trajectory of this schooling, however, is best understood not in relation to democratic ideology, but in its relation to industrialism and the new forms of social organization being developed. Schooling was to, quote, assimilate the immigrants and teach all children to shun the moral temptations of modern life, unquote. Eventually, schools became graded, policy-making centralized, curricula standardized, and architecture uniform. What emerged were systems of public education, education having acquired its entirely institutional character. This development paved the way for the sterile bureaucracy of the 20th century. The schools became important auxiliary institutions up to the factory, teaching children to be orderly and tractable. An important transitional period, 1800 to 1830 CE, and the development of industrial society in England and America was marked by a type of school known as a Lancaster or monitorial school. Such schools were originally inspired by the schooling system in India, whereby the caste system was preserved through the gathering of hundreds of children from the bottom two castes, 95% of the population, into big rooms where they were taught self-abnegation and little else by a Brahmin. Joseph Lancaster, after reading a report of the Hindu system, worked to establish similar schools in England and the United States. These schools are very much like factories, emphasizing economy, routine, and competition. While this particular form of school did not survive, the ethos that informed the Lancasterian system continued. In other words, the factory continued to be a model for schools. Schooling became inextricably tied to the reproduction of the new industrial order and capitalist social relations. Given the importance of the new schooling system, it is no wonder that schooling would soon become compulsory. America's compulsory school system was inspired by the first effective compulsory school system, which was developed in Prussia and functional by 1819. Quote, in 1806, in the Battle of Jena, Napoleon crushed the military forces of Prussia, and in the Treaty of Tilsit, by which peace was concluded in 1807, he exacted severe and humiliating terms of the defeated nation. Unquote. A wave of Prussian nationalism swept over the nation, creating a massive compulsory education system aimed at creating patriotic masses that would die for their country, was seen by leaders as the way to assure national greatness. Johann Gottlieb Fichte, the most influential proponent of such a system, wanted students to develop a love of, quote, regular and progressive mental activity, unquote, that would direct them toward a life of service to society. He was preoccupied with the importance of an, quote, image of a moral order of life, and the good, as opposed to my good, simply as such and for its own sake, unquote. From the Swiss educator Jean-Henri Pestalozzi, the father of the modern elementary school, the Prussians learned of the great potential of modern common schools. The Prussian schools formed at this time were divided into three categories: Akademischulen for future policymakers, that was 1% of students; Realschulen for future professionals, 5 to 7.5% of students; and Volksschulen, which emphasized obedience for everyone else. Horace Mann visited Prussia in the 1840s and praised the Prussian schooling system in his 7th annual report. The curious thing which Mann neglects to mention is that he, quote, arrived in Prussia when its schools were closed for vacation. He toured empty classrooms, spoke with authorities, interviewed vacationing schoolmasters, and read piles of dusty official reports, unquote. Nonetheless, Mann's glowing report accurately represents his opinion of the Prussian system. He was particularly impressed by the Prussian classification of scholars throughout their course of instruction and their enforcement of compulsory school laws. Quote, after a child has arrived at the legal age for attending school, whether he be the child of noble or of peasant, the only two absolute grounds of exemption from attendance are sickness and death. The German language has a word for which we have no equivalent either in language or in idea. The word is used in reference to children and signifies due to the school. That is, when the legal age for going to school arrives, The right of the school to the child's attendance attaches, just as, with us, the right of a creditor to the payment of a note or bond attaches on the day of its maturity. Unquote. Slowly but surely, the state was able to impose compulsory attendance on the citizenry. During the latter half of the 19th century, the United States, France, and England all established systems of public education with compulsory attendance. John Taylor Gatto describes the imposition of compulsory attendance in America. Quote, "Our form of compulsory schooling is an invention of the state of Massachusetts around 1850. It was resisted, sometimes with guns, by an estimated 80% of the Massachusetts population, the last outpost in Barnstable on Cape Cod not surrendering their children until the 1880s, when the area was seized by militia and children marched to school under guard." Unquote. By 1900, most states had government schools and compulsory attendance. An area of investigation that very clearly shows the role of schooling in a society is the conflict between a society that has schools, like the United States, and societies that don't, American Indians. During the 300 years following the establishment of a Jesuit missionary school in Havana, Florida, in 1568 CE, Catholic and Protestant religious groups dominated attempts to educate Indian youth. It was in the 19th century that schooling came to be seen as a way of assimilating young Indians into the dominant, that is, white, society. Civilization, Christianity, and farming were to be the values forced upon the, quote, uncivilized. Quote, "In 1819, Congress established a civilization fund, which lasted until 1873, when the Bureau of Indian Affairs took control of Indian education, to provide financial support to religious groups and other interested individuals who were willing to live among and teach Indians." Unquote. The House's committee that recommended the creation of the fund revealed the philosophy behind the program. Quote, "Put into the hands of their children the primer and the hoe, and they will naturally in time take hold of the plow, and they will grow up in habits of morality and industry." Unquote. In many treaties with Indians from 1778 till 1871, when Congress stopped recognizing tribes as independent powers, the government made education provisions. But it was not until after the reservation system was established, following the California Gold Rush of 1849, and the building of Western Railroads, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs took control, that Indian education became more of a systematic effort of acculturation. A significant figure in Indian education was Richard Henry Pratt, who, while serving in the army, had helped bring about the collapse of the Southern Plains tribes. The fact that there was little contradiction between killing Indians and educating them says a lot about the way many educators viewed the natives. Pratt felt that in order to save the man, it was necessary to kill the Indian. He believed that Indians could, if instructed properly, be fully incorporated into American society. After the defeat of the Southern Plains tribes, Pratt took on the task of being the jailer for 72 of the most intractable Kiowa, Comanche, and Cheyenne at a new prison in Fort Marion, Florida. In 3 years, he was able to convince himself and others that Indians could be transformed into proper citizens. He went on to found the Carlisle Indian School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Quote, "The opening of Carlisle Indian School in 1879 came just at this time policymakers were desperately searching for a means of absorbing Indians into the larger society. Between 1879 and 1900, the Bureau of Indian Affairs created 24 off-reservation schools, roughly modeled after the Carlisle prototype. By 1900, the Indian school system had taken on the shape of an institutional hierarchy. When the systems functioned according to plan, students progressed from reservation day schools to reservation boarding schools, finally moving on to Carlisle-type off-reservation schools. By 1900, three-quarters of all Indian children were enrolled in boarding school, with approximately a third of this number in off-reservation schools. Unquote. Children, quote, were taken from their grieving parents and kept for years, punished for speaking their own language and brainwashed of all traces of Indianness. Unquote. Students, often with the help of their parents, sometimes went to great lengths to resist schooling experience. The problem, as one Indian agent put it, was that they had not, quote, not yet reached the state of civilization to know the advantages of education and consequently look upon schoolwork with abhorrence, unquote. When parents refused to enroll their children in schools, Indian agents employed by the state had the power to withhold rations or use the police to track down the children and force them to go to school. Thomas J. Morgan, the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, wrote in 1892 that he did not believe that Indians, quote, have the right to forcibly keep their children out of school, unquote. Students resisted in a variety of different ways. Simply running away was very common, some risking death or dying on their journey home. Even, quote, mysterious fires were somewhat common. In 1897, two Carlisle girls tried to burn down the girls' dormitory twice in the same day, once right after the bell for supper and once just after the bell for chapel. At Fort Mojave, several kindergartners were locked up in the school jail for reportedly running away from the school. During breakfast one morning, the kindergartners not locked up used a large log as a battering ram, broke through the jail door, and ran for the river bottom with their rescued classmates. Schools represented, especially to American Indians, a new relationship to space, which was conceived of in linear terms. Lines, corners, squares, and straight rows represented industrial civilization's relationship to wilderness. Space was colonized by the disciplinary imperative. Freedom of movement was carefully regulated. As the student learns to heed the teacher's commands, he internalizes the discipline that shapes individuals. Quote, a relation of surveillance defined and regulated is inscribed at the heart of the practice of teaching, not as an additional or adjacent part, but as a mechanism that is inherent to it, which increases its effectiveness. Is it any wonder that schools resemble prisons? As Morris and Rothman wrote, quote, with no ironies intended, they, 19th century prison reformers, talked about the penitentiary as serving as a model for the family and the school. Foucault has written of the transition from the penality of spectacular torture to that of an organized prison system, roughly coinciding with the emergence of the nation-state and the Industrial Revolution. Quote, the reform of criminal law must be read as a strategy for the re-engagement, the rearrangement of the power to punish, according to modalities that render it more regular, more effective, more constant, and more detailed in its effects. End quote. An early reformer, Cesar Beccaria, wrote that, quote, the most certain method of preventing crimes is to perfect the system of education, unquote. Sometime later, Horace Mann declared that, quote, school is the cheapest police, unquote. By the time the common schools had proven their utility, the very wealthy took a marked interest in education. Cornelius Vanderbilt, Ezra Cornell, James Duke, and Leland Stanford created universities bearing their names. The universities were meant to train the middlemen of the American system, who who would uphold its values. Teachers, doctors, lawyers, administrators, engineers, technicians, politicians. As late as 1915, Carnegie and Rockefeller alone were spending more on education than the government was. Quote, "In our dreams, people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands, those of Carnegie's General Education Board." Unquote. Marvin Lazerson wrote of the formation of the urban school system at the turn of the century, quote, "What had been an amorphous collection of parochial and virtually autonomous agencies under the guidance of transient untrained teachers became an integrated system whose characteristics were strikingly similar across the nation, and whose tone was set by a professionally certified interest group." Unquote. By 1914, 12 of the 20 largest cities in Massachusetts had public kindergartens, which were intended to domesticate the slum child and teach the parent, through the child, how to be a good parent. Frederick Froebel had founded the first kindergarten, or literally, a garden of children, in 1837, and the proliferation of kindergartens allowed educators to better shape the young child's character. The new schooling system was seemingly unstoppable, irreversible. Quote, "Just see," said Carnegie, "whenever we peer into the first tiny springs of the national life, how this true panacea for all the ills of the body politic bubbles forth. Education, education, education!" End quote. There was resistance, but usually not enough to really threaten this constant bubbling forth. The Irish community, for example, boycotted and may have tried to burn down a school in Lowell, Massachusetts. But over time, truant officers were employed and the institution moved ahead, as it did across the United States. Parents often faced fines or the possibility of arrest if they refused to send their children. The Progressive Movement, 1890 to 1930, was philosophically concerned with tailoring education to the needs of the child. Practically, this meant categorizing, observing, testing, and controlling the child to smooth the transition to corporate capitalism. Education became quite the religious calling. Quote, "Every teacher should realize he is a social servant set apart for the maintenance of the proper social order and the securing of the right social growth. In this way, the teacher always is the prophet of the true God and the usherer in of the true kingdom of God," wrote John Dewey. Understood metaphorically, the kingdom of God could signify a new era of capitalism, although Dewey considered himself a socialist. To focus on politics would be to miss the point. Social order, the, quote, subsumption of the individual, had become a good in and of itself. Progress is what matters, the truth behind the capitalism. Raymond E. Callahan observed the real structural changes shaping modern schooling. The adoption of business values in educational administration started around 1900, and by 1930, administrators saw themselves as business managers or, quote, school executives. Emphasis was placed on accounting, finance, public relations, and running schools like businesses. At the annual meeting of the National Education Association in 1905, George H. Martin, Secretary of the State Board of Education in Massachusetts, decried the fact that, quote, "educational processes seem unscientific, crude, and wasteful," unquote, when compared to modern business practices. In 1907, William C. Bagley published Classroom Management, which concerned itself with the most efficient operation of, quote, "the school plant." School boards were increasingly dominated by businessmen, and a more utilitarian, career-focused education was called for. Quote, "We couldn't ask more from a patriotic motive than scientific management gives from a selfish one," said Theodore Roosevelt, obviously full of enthusiasm. Frederick Winslow Taylor, who developed scientific management, clearly grasped the import of his ideas when he wrote, quote, "In the past, the man has been first. In the future, the system must be first," end quote. Taylor saw that the best type of industrial management and operation in his time was based on the workman taking initiative and the employer giving some special incentive in order to keep the worker motivated and productive. Taylor's idea of scientific management, or task management, was that the employer could even more effectively and efficiently secure the initiative of workmen by studying the tasks of the workmen and developing a science for each element of the man's work, and then selecting and training workmen best suited for the tasks which the employer had familiarized himself with. By studying tasks, assigning workmen to definite tasks which they are to perform within a specified amount of time, and monitoring the workman's progress, the employer takes on new responsibilities, but will be able to greatly increase the efficiency of his operation. Taylor was indifferent to the dehumanizing aspects of scientific management. He felt that an increase in efficiency would bring greater prosperity to all, and the rights of the people, in other words, people as consumers, were more important to him than those of employers or employees. Scientific management sounded the death knell for what was left of the dignity or autonomy of labor, a prerequisite for the fast-paced consumer culture of today. There was much enthusiasm for scientific management in the corporate world, and especially the corporate media. Articles appeared in popular magazines seeking to apply Taylor's principles to the army, the legal profession, the home, the family, the household, the church, and of course, education. Taylor's ideas, quote, "were adopted, interpreted, and applied chiefly by administrators, and while the greatest impact was upon administration, the administrator and the professional training programs of administration, whose influence extended to all of American education from the elementary schools to the universities," end quote. An abstract of a speech regarding the application of scientific management to schools, delivered to the High School Teachers Association of New York City, was published in the bulletin. A. Purpose or object of scientific management. 1. To increase the efficiency of the laborer, i.e., the pupil. 2. To increase quality of the product, i.e., the pupil. 3. Thereby to increase the amount of output and the value to the capitalist. Another development was the Gary Plan, started in Gary, Indiana, in 1908 by William A. Wirt, superintendent of schools there at the time. The Gary Plan consisted of the departmentalization of school subjects and children being platooned into groups that would use assembly rooms, gymnasiums, shops, laboratories, and playgrounds at the same time as other groups used classrooms, so that all facilities were being utilized, and at the sounding of the bell, children would change classes. The Gary Plan allowed administrators to show how efficient they were. After it was endorsed by the Federal Bureau of Education in 1914, it was blocked in New York in 1917, where riots broke out in opposition to it. Schools were stoned, and police tires slashed, and 300 students, mostly Jewish, were arrested. Nonetheless, by 1929, the Gary Plan, or variants of it, were in operation in 1,068 schools in over 202 cities. After 1930, this specific form of schooling declined, yet Wirt's innovations left a permanent mark on schooling in general. With the increasing specialization of American life came the growth of specialized training in education. As John Taylor Gatto observed, quote, "Before the 20th century, there was no parasitic army of assistant principals, coordinators, and assorted bureaucratic specialists," end quote. The increasing complexity of the administrative hierarchy and the proliferation of standardized tests helped to ensure teacher conformity. Given impetus after the work of Edward Lee Thorndike Standardized testing spread rapidly after World War I, and the Carnegie Corporation poured over $3 million into the effort. Worldwide, universal primary education became the goal of virtually all governments in the post-World War II era. Also in this era, higher education experienced tremendous growth in industrialized countries, nations. More and more money is being put towards postgraduate training and scientific and engineering research and experimental development. Schooling in America looks now like a finely tuned behavior modification machine, channeling people into various meaningless jobs for the rest of their lives. Schooling produces masses of people, not autonomous individuals. Individual parts of the schooling machine don't really matter anymore. Technology has obviously served to institute new forms of social control, as Marcuse observed in One Dimensional Man. Our very consciousness is surrounded on all sides by a mass media, and in this modern context, schooling becomes a technique of propaganda that functions through the use of knowledge, not in the service of any classical ideal. When Jacques Ellul wrote about modern propaganda in Propaganda, the Formation of Men's Attitudes, he emphasized that it is above all a set of methods of a technological society based on mass media that addresses individuals only as members of a mass that shares common feelings and myths. Ellul pointed out that not all propaganda is explicitly political. Schooling is a type of sociological propaganda aimed at the integration of this individual into the social group. As students go hazily from class to class, box to box, schooling as a technique of social control perpetuates itself. And as leftists drone on about better education for the people, for the masses of people, they are unaware of what an important role they play in reproducing existing social and economic formations.